Hi, you're listening to Manufactured, a podcast about sustainability and the making of fashion. I'm your host, Kim van der Weert, a student of human rights, turned garment factory manager, turned sustainable fashion critic. On this show, I talk to some of the most integral people who manufacture what we wear. They aren't the people you see in fashion magazines, they're the people behind closed doors working in fashion supply chains. On the one hand, people often talk about legislation and regulation as if it's the golden ticket out of fashion sustainability problems. The logic goes something like this. The reason, quote-unquote, bad stuff happens in fashion supply chains is because of weak governance, quote-unquote, over there. Therefore, we must hold brands and retailers in the global north legally accountable for their impacts, including throughout their supply chains, primarily in the global south. In other words, those global brands and retailers are filling governance gaps, again, quote-unquote, over there. On the other hand, there's the curious case of apparel production in Leicester. Despite being in the heart of the UK, a quote-unquote developed country and leading superpower that's decidedly not, again, quote-unquote, over there, labor rights abuses in Leicester's garment sector have long been described as an open secret. This mini-series is dedicated to exploring this paradox. How is it possible that, despite strong governance and regulation, labor rights abuses have persisted in Leicester? What are the lessons and implications for our efforts to leverage legislation as a tool to fix fashion's sustainability woes globally? Each episode is a conversation with a different stakeholder group. We talk to a lawyer working on human rights abuses in Leicester, the leader of a local manufacturing association, a policy expert and government official, and a former production worker who, in recent years, has begun working in community engagement. This series has been co-created with Dr. Divya Jyoti, who some of you may remember meeting on the show before. Divya, a sustainability professional in a past life, is now a lecturer in the Department of Organization, Work and Technology at Lancaster University in the UK. She researches issues of ethics and sustainability in fashion supply chains while continuing her work with reform-oriented organizations. This mini-series has been supported by Lancaster University Management School and the Pentland Center for Sustainability in Business at Lancaster University, working in partnership with Justice in Fashion CIC, a UK-based not-for-profit that works to address imbalances of power and resources across the fashion industry supply chain. Last thing, we want this series to generate discussion and to be a two-way conversation. Share your musings, ramblings, or questions, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Links to both the voice memo and the community wall can be found in the episode description. We're also going to be doing a live virtual conversation on 3 October to debrief and compare notes on these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Register via the link also in the episode description. In this episode, my co-host Dr. Divya Jyoti and I are in conversation with Sajjad Khan, the founder of the Apparel and Textile Manufacturers Federation, commonly referred to as ATMF. It's an organization that was founded to provide a voice and a platform for garment producers in the UK. Sajjad, whose family lived in Leicester, had no dreams of entering its manufacturing industry. After leaving for the US to become a commercial pilot, Sajjad had to forego his plans and return to the city to look after his father. It was during this time that his friend and now wife was eager to start her own manufacturing company in the city. In 1991, the duo founded their own manufacturing company, where Sajjad has served as managing director for over 32 years. Today, in his role at ATMF, Sajjad helps bring together different manufacturers from across the UK fashion supply chain to form a collective voice when negotiating with the government and various brands. Sajjad shares his perspectives on the constraints manufacturers in Leicester face and whether the slew of initiatives aimed at improving labor practices have appropriately addressed those constraints. He also shares his thoughts on what kinds of solutions would be better. Now you're working with an organization called ATMF, and I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about what that is and your role within it.
ATMF is the Apparel and Textile Manufacturers Federation. This came about as a result of some of the negative publicity we had about 3 years ago from the Boohoo fallout. Unfortunately, it just sort of decimated the vertical supply chain in Leicester because of the practices of some of Boohoo's suppliers. There was only a handful, but it had a huge impact on some of the better manufacturers here. The whole city became tarnished with the same brush. And one of the things we felt as manufacturers that this was an unfair representation. After some major conversations between us as suppliers, we decided to get together and form this federation through a sort of conversation with the local government, some of the manufacturers, some of the brands, some of the other government agencies, even at national level. Unfortunately, we had a lot of pushback from all of those. They just felt that the whole city was an issue. And there was no real support from these guys. But we persevered. We pushed. So we took up this challenge and continued to sort of push towards taking to a national level. We had a chat with the business secretary, the House of Commons, and then just by sheer chance, I think they bought into what we wanted to do and asked us, you know, if we are sort of interested in launching this federation and they will allow space in the House of Commons to do this. I think that came as a shock to us all because I think they're bought into the idea that this is actually a really good project and it needs some real input. So we went back. We had a major conversation with the city council, and city council and the other local sort of offices only sort of react to something positive that's happening elsewhere if there's some PR to be gained from these. And so they then started to support us, and we went back to the House of Commons, and on the 17th, 18th of July, we launched this federation.
And so this was launched in which year?
2022.
Okay. So is it fair to say like you're kind of an industry association, or would you describe it differently?
It's a collaborative association that's trying to represent the whole vertical supply chains. We have the whole gambit, including printers, suppliers, knitters, dyers, manufacturers. By and large, there has been a lot of positive feedback as a result of this, because I think they've realized that there has to be some interaction with manufacturers if they want to see some change.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what this whole show is about, right? That's the concept for this podcast, too. So I think we're very aligned there. You started to give some context sort of in the last couple of years with the scandals and the media reports during the pandemic as sort of the short-term catalyst for the creation of ATMF. But I want to go back. How has the apparel sector in Leicester changed over the last few decades? And you already were, I think, starting to allude to this sort of prior to the pandemic that maybe are useful to talk about to give further context for why this moment, why did ATMF come in 2022?
You're already aware Leicester has a huge heritage of the textile sector. In the 30s, it was known as city that clothes the world. In the 70s, we were, I think, the second richest city in Europe, as a matter of fact. So it had huge pedigree from all of this. And over the 70s and 80s especially, we lost a lot of this production. And it was a concern to many of us. Our USP was the fact that we were able to produce fashion very quickly. So our speed to market was the strength that we had here. And we didn't really want to lose that, but we didn't have focus. We didn't have direction. And so when some of the lesser brands and the local wholesalers came in, they took in the production. So it gave the city the strength to survive. Unfortunately, it didn't allow the city to invent or reinvent itself. So we continued a model that went sort of downhill based on pricing structure. It became a race to the bottom. And that caused a lot of concern to some of the better, more established manufacturers because they were being undercut by the smaller businesses that were so easy to establish. One of the biggest issues that we had here is that almost anybody can start manufacturing, simply because we had the infrastructure, but also it required no real expertise. So you just bring in a few machines, get some employees, tie up with one of the wholesalers, and they'll tell you what to do, and you just sort of continue to produce. It meant we lost some of the skill set that we used to have. So it became cheap, cheerful, fast fashion, fast in the sense of cheap fashion rather than speed to market fashion. And that became the norm. So the city became stagnant in its invention, but it increased in its capacity. I think that was our main concern. The quality was going but the quantity was sort of increasing. The initial production sort of capacity that we had in Leicester was specific for some of the bigger brands. There was a lot of interaction with the, again, I can allude to the likes of Marks and Spencer's, Next, River Island. They booked in capacity and they used some really good factories that were based here. When they disappeared, we didn't know what to do. So some of these bigger factories unfortunately closed and smaller ones arose as a result to take advantage of unregulated practices. And they took on the new wholesalers that were coming. The wholesalers, as far as the technical side of it is concerned, is people who buy in bulk and then sell on to smaller individual shops and small boutiques, things like that. So their demands were a little different, and their pricing as a result was a bit different as well. They wanted to pay less because they wanted to build in a margin for themselves and then sell on to other independent stores. We still had some interaction with brands here, but it became less and less as a result.
You started when we were asking a little bit about ATMF and what it is, and you mentioned, you know, that it's kind of like an association, but it more of like a collaborative one, and that it includes all these different parts of the production process. And I want to ask you, you know, why do you think that manufacturers need their own collective voice? As we're talking about the history over the last couple of decades, can you give examples of how maybe lack of collective manufacturer voice has shaped the way that the industry has evolved?
Yes, a number of good quality manufacturers raised their concerns many, many years ago because we were being undercut by cheap, cheerful labor that sort of didn't really care about the working practices. They didn't care about quality, and it undermined just the manufacturing side of it, but the city image. And that's what our concern was. But unfortunately, there wasn't real appetite to do an organization like the one we have now. It's when the Boohoo scandal came along and it just wouldn't die away. It impacted almost everybody in the sector. We personally lost a lot of our business as a result, even though we were using audited factories and our buyers used to come and work within our premises almost 10 times a year. They used to be here for 2 days at a time, working with us, developing new brand and new styles. But the whole idea that it originated from Leicester, it became a sort of a negative for them. So they pulled out. They decided no longer want to source from Leicester. And that was an issue for us because we had a customer base that was consistent and loyal to us for almost 18 years at the time. And same thing happened to a number of other manufacturers as well. So we felt that we needed a pushback on this and we needed to make sure that we are heard as well. The idea of ATMF as a result was that we needed to get in some of the better suppliers, collaborate and have a conversation around what happened, why things went wrong, and how we can move forward as a result.
And I'm curious because this is something that's been on my mind for years. I sort of share your conviction that manufacturers would probably be better off globally as well, if they were working a little bit more collectively to sort of shape the way that certain conversations are going, because I think their perspectives are often misunderstood and underrepresented. But also, it's very difficult as one manufacturer to sort of shape the direction of this conversation. And I think it really requires coming together. But at the same time, if I think about my own experience at sort of the global level, there is so much competition on price. You know, the owner of the company that I worked for has been on this show on the record saying that he lost orders for less than half a cent. But I think there's also even just like language barriers at a global level as well. I mean, the sector is so cutthroat that at least at a global level, I think that that really leads to a lot of fear between manufacturers themselves and prevents this kind of collective voice that you're describing. And I'm curious, I mean, did you guys face this barrier as well, or were there other barriers?
I think there's certainly need for a collective voice, whether it's local or global. I think the idea of having a global voice for manufacturers, it would be a brilliant concept, but it would be quite difficult to manage. But on a local level, we certainly felt it was necessary. As I said earlier, that the pushback was quite immense because one thing that happens when you become a voice for the manufacturers is that the brands now have to then listen to you. And I think one of the biggest issues that we have is the idea of a fair price. So if you don't have a fair price that reflects your changing needs for ethical requirements, as well as things like minimum wage increases and all those kind of things, if you're not able to pass that forward onto your buyer and therefore in turn to your consumer, it has a huge impact. I mean, I remember this, some of our manufacturers came to us last year that we had, I think, 9% minimum wage increase. And they tried to ask the brands to let them build that into their costing. And the brands responded by saying, sorry, we're already having issues ourselves on retail. We actually expect you to give us a 10% discount on your product. So the net impact was almost 20% as a result. So there's a limit as to how much the manufacturers can do and give back. So when you're sort of reducing your profit margins continuously, you have three choices. One, close up. Two, reduce your quality. Three, look at practices that are unethical, and that will help you to survive. That's your three choices. You just have to pick one then as a result. And I don't think that's a choice that manufacturers should have to face. It should be a collective effort by both manufacturers and obviously the brands. But there's a further concept to be attached to this. And one, I think, is about the education to our consumer, especially in the UK, where we have become so used to cheap and huge demand of sort of throwaway items. We need to look at that. And we need to see how that's impacting, one, the environment, and secondly, the supply chain itself. So if we can focus a little bit more on quality rather than quantity.
Hi. Sometimes I feel kind of like a madwoman sitting in my living room recording myself talk. If you want to help me with that feeling, share your musings, ramblings, or questions, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Links to both the voice memo and the community wall can be found in the episode description. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on October 3rd to debrief and compare notes on these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Register via the link in the episode description. I want to come back to this dilemma that you've put on the table for what choices do manufacturers have in these situations, you know, either close, produce products of a lesser quality, or engage in some kind of dubious behavior. Were manufacturers themselves like up for this idea of ATMF, or did it take some convincing, or was the Boohoo scandal like just such a rock bottom that people were like, yeah, let's do this?
There were two things that were happening. One, they tried to find a production base elsewhere, like some Morocco, Tunisia, Turkey, and obviously other parts of the world. Well, the other idea was to sort of try to talk and negotiate with the brands. And they didn't get any response from the brands as far as pricing or commitment to production was concerned. And as a result, they saw this as an opportunity to sort of have a collective voice. So the initial idea that there should be a representative voice was not very well taken, but we persevered. Over about 6-7 month period, it started to become more favorable. And the buy-in started to take place. But just a huge backlash on the city was one of the factors that had caused people to rethink their manufacturing, especially when they've been in this trade for 30, 40 years. Just saw this as a real shame that the people who have been manufacturing, who have been the backbone of the city, employing thousands of people, are not being supported. And this was our conflict with the local government, that there should have been some support given to these manufacturers.
But one of the questions I wanted to ask you was whether you saw a connection between the lack of sort of collective voice at the manufacturer level and these reported human rights abuses that came out during the pandemic. And if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that, yes, there was, because the fact that there was no collective voice at the manufacturing level meant that on the one hand, it was very difficult to negotiate with brands, but also that you weren't getting the right kind of support that you needed from local government. Is that a fair interpretation of what you've just shared or not?
That is fair. That's a fair interpretation. I think the idea of having a collective voice would also have helped us to standardize some of the working practices, because when there is peer pressure to do the right thing and also name and shame as a result of this, then there is a real appetite to sort of do things the right way. there was no real pressure from anybody to audit the factories. That was a discretion of the buyers or the brands that you're working with. Some brands required it and some didn't. But when you're not sort of accountable to people, then you know you have a choice on how to run your business.
I want to pause on this word accountable, because a lot of people who are listening might be saying, well, what do you mean they're not accountable? They're in the UK. The UK is like a quote unquote functioning government. Can you expand on what you mean by that? And also that manufacturers weren't getting what they needed from local government. And I'm curious to hear more about that. What did they need that they weren't getting? But also, like, why was this accountability as far as government oversight? Why was that failing from your perspective?
Obviously, you have government agencies that sort of work towards looking at minimum wage and other ethical practices, but they were quite strict in their approach to the textile sector. They allowed things to sort of exist and sort of relied on good faith of the businesses to do the right thing, which by and large most people did. There's no doubt about that. But you will always find a bunch of factories that will want to do things slightly different. One of the things that we found in the UK is the legislation in terms of being strict on enforcing some of these illegal practices that have been carried out and then sort of holding people to account. I know, for instance, my own personal experience that there was one factory that was found to have a number of illegal workers. They were fined. And a few days later, these guys closed up and restarted under a brand new name. With no accountability. So little things like that do not help ethical manufacturers when you allow loopholes where people can come in and restart without accountability. So these are the things that we wanted to push towards to sort of tighten the loophole on.
Let me try to summarize to see if I understood correctly. So the thing that you sort of as a group of manufacturers were needing or wanting from government was really about advocating for closing certain loopholes and really pushing the enforcement of the standard up to a certain level that you mentioned as a manufacturer. When you're in this situation, you have three choices. You either close, you shut up shop, you produce at a lesser quality, or I guess when we were talking about this dubious behavior as being your third option, that's pursuing these kinds of loopholes. And so as manufacturers, what you would have wanted from the local government would have been to sort of close these loopholes that permitted or allowed some of that bad practice to continue. Is that fair?
In a way. I mean, some of the practices are probably not within the capacity of the local government. It needed probably national government inputs. So we have talked about the idea of a garment adjudicator.
And what's a garment adjudicator? Can you explain that concept?
It's very similar to what we have in the UK, so the food adjudicator that sort of oversees a fair pricing, for instance, better working practices within the food industry, the agriculture industry. And we wanted something similar to that within the textile sector so that there is a level of communication between a manufacturer and the retailers. So that we can come to some sort of level playing field. At the moment, the power dynamics are such that there is too much power within the retailers, and we're kind of forced in a way to do certain things which cannot be costed into a garment. So we're just looking at ideas of having a better communication, asking the brands to educate some of their younger buyers. I think some of the younger buyers don't really understand the costing of a garment. They're given a price on which to work on, and they're asked to go and attain that price. Now, they really need to be educated on how a garment is structured and then therefore costed properly. So these are the kind of things that we were looking for from a national government sort of or a garment adjudicated level.
So on the one hand, you know, you're talking about at the local level, actual enforcement and closure of some of these loopholes, but also at the national level, support with sort of the commercial balance of power, I guess you could say, and making sure that there's certain support from government in terms of making sure that you guys are getting fair prices. How did I do there? Am I a bit better, a bit closer to what you intended to say?
That's a fair assessment, but I think it's unfortunately a common problem around the world. As far as pricing is concerned, everyone wants a price that is commercially viable for them. But the impact of all of that is that it has a knockdown effect on the supply chain. For it to be a healthy, survivable supply chain, everybody must be able to make something from it and therefore use it to sort of reinvest, reinvigorate, educate their employees, and then continue to sort of flourish. If there's only one person making something from the supply chain, it will have a negative impact. And that's probably one of the major factors that we as a city have suffered as a result, that we're trying to compete with other parts of the world who have a better pricing structure than we do, produce at the same price as those parts of the world. And it just isn't feasible. We have a minimum wage structure here that rises by at least 2 times a year, between 5 to 10% a year. Unless those costs are added into the garment and then it's therefore pushed forward to the consumer, it's just no longer feasible. And that's why as an organization, we're educating our members to move towards quality production. We need to focus more on quality so we can bring in better brands and yield a better price.
Divya, I want to turn to you because as I'm thinking about where this conversation sits within the global picture, kind of where my mind is going is like back to this word that has come up in almost every conversation we've had, which is inequity. One of the things that you as a group of manufacturers would have been looking for in terms of support from government was support in terms of addressing this inequity. In this case, we're talking about inequity between the brands and the retailers and the manufacturers. The fact that this was not being addressed was one of the major barriers to actually sort of bringing about positive change for the sector. And that actually the way that you've gone about trying to address that in Leicester has been to bring manufacturers together to have a collective voice. So there's kind of two parts to the conversation. Is it feasible, possible, when we talk about legislation happening at the global level, or rather in the global north, that is trying to hold global brands and retailers accountable for what happens in their supply chains around the world? Is it possible, feasible? Is there any sort of scenario in which manufacturers might have a collective voice in that space, number one? And number two, is it possible, feasible, that legislation itself might actually fill some of these gaps around inequity between buyers and suppliers? That's kind of where my head's at. But how about you, Divya?
So I think in some ways, a couple of themes were, I would say, coming to my mind. I think the first is this inequity in enforcement, which is what I think Saj was alluding to, that there are violations which are happening. And it seems that perhaps there were challenges in terms of enforcement within particular, I don't know, physical locations, particular kind of firms, particular kind of violations which weren't picked up, whereas others are picked up. And especially when we think about legislation, and I think we've touched upon this before, we need to think about enforcement. So I think that's one issue which has emerged. The second is this theme around collective voice. And as you were talking and, you know, you were saying that in the face of the scandal, suddenly it became easier to come together. And in my head, I was actually thinking about Rana Plaza and its aftermath. That's the analogy it almost kind of evoked, because when things went wrong, it became easier for the workers and various not-for-profits to come together. In the aftermath of certain kinds of issues being raised, perhaps people become more open to change. They become more willing to listen. We can have those contentions about what might lead to that collective voice coming together. But the point which was coming to my mind was that perhaps when we are thinking about these legislative approaches, it's not just the outlining what needs to be done, particularly when you think about this due diligence, right? That's what the legislation is about. It's maybe also thinking about the principles, and maybe collective voice needs to be ingrained in that as perhaps one of the ways where legislation may play a role in equalizing the inequity of power relationships, which does exist. I also have another one, which I want to take the opportunity to share, because what you spoke about was that there has been this consistent race to bottom, and maybe there's a need for an anti-competition law. Maybe what we need is a global floor price. When you think about this, the garment industry, and I'm speaking very specific to it, because we keep talking about human rights due diligence, in some ways knowing fully well that price is a factor. Commercial aspects are the drivers. And that's what Fajr's points have really highlighted. Like in farm-based industries, there is a minimum price, right? There's a guaranteed price and the government kind of chips in. I don't know if we need to open up that conversation, you know, for an industry like this.
Saj, any thoughts from you? And I'm also curious, I realized I should have asked you, but you talked about the unevenness in enforcement at the local government level. And I wanted to ask you, like, why does that happen from your perspective? Because that's maybe actually not something I understand.
I think one of the things that there is a little bit of confusion as to who's actually responsible, whether it's the local government or whether it's the national government. So that confusion has sort of played into the hands of some of these illegal practices. But where we were 3 years ago to where we are now, I think there's a shift. The people that we felt were so shouldn't be in the trade are no longer there by and large. So I think some of the practices that we were worried about have sort of moved on. But one of the things from my own perspective is that how we, picking up on Divya's point, is that we actually need to maybe get some government support, because the city is actually a really great city to have local supply chain. So for us to realize now that we've lost, first of all our manufacturing, there was a push from UK at one time to become a service sector rather than a manufacturing sector. So we lost a lot of our industry, manufacturing industry, to other parts of the world. And this is one of our last sort of remaining bastions, and if we lose this as well, we will struggle. So that's why I think it's important that we bring back some of the manufacturing gear, but also for the government to be directly involved to ensure that we are bringing in the right kind of business back to UK by supporting it. Maybe look at some aspect of subsidies to sort of encourage better invention, better innovation, more sort of a conducive factory environment in which to work in. And also, not just that, to almost make it a point that everyone should be audited at some point on a regular basis. So when you have industry that gives you a free hand, whether you want to do audit or not, it doesn't quite work. I think everyone should be playing by the same rules. And having an organization like ATMF, it doesn't have to be ours. It could be some other organization that sort of takes care of its members and makes them accountable. So if you're accountable to one to an audit body, one to a local organization, and thirdly, obviously, to the national government, you can put checks and balances in to make sure that these people are now sort of working on a certain standard. Again, it all goes back down to the fact that there has to be buy-in for a price structure that will come out as a result of this, because everything requires a cost. And that cost cannot just be borne by a manufacturer all the time, because it just, there isn't the profit margin there to sort of keep doing things at the expectations of others and not be able to pass the costs on.
I just want to say that actually when you were saying, one of the thoughts coming to my mind is that in some ways this whole emphasis to legislate also, you know, comes back to the same point around inequity. In the beginning, Saj said a beautiful thing that, and I'm saying it beautiful, although he didn't mean it as beautiful, that there was almost this expectation that there are people who will do their job the way they are supposed to do. Now, because of market pressures, some did it, and then they were undercut by those who were not really doing it. So there is then a need for more enforcement, more policing, which that generates. But that's where the question is. I mean, as you were speaking, I've just written, how much can you truly legislate, right? How do you come up with a uniform definition? And I think what you cannot necessarily standardize practices and behaviors, but what you can standardize is the number. And hence I'm saying, let's talk about that minimum price, that I cannot buy a t-shirt for cheaper than 10 quid. It's just not possible. Which means that there is a floor thing which is guaranteed, right? And it can be above that. And maybe that's where we need to change the conversation.
Thank you for listening to Manufactured. I've been your host, Kim van der Weert. And if you learned something new from this episode and want to support the show, come say hi to me on LinkedIn. Also, share your musings, ramblings, or questions about this episode, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on the 3rd of October to debrief and compare notes about these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Links to the voice memo, community wall, and event registration page can be found in the episode description. And of course, subscribe, rate, and review us on the podcast app you're listening to this episode on.